Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly macro dose of libertarianism from the magazine of Free Minds and Free Markets. I'm Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Greetings, colleagues.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
So, a common thread on the traffic leaderboard of the Reason website last week, not that we look at that, was the fault line or fault lines between libertarianism and the current state of theoretical and applied American conservatism nearly 8 years after Donald Trump escalated into our political lives. I'll just read some headlines to give you a taste of what I am talking about. The post-liberal authoritarians want you to forget that private companies have rights. Conservatives pushing common good capitalism sound a lot like progressives. Ron DeSantis confirms again that his attack on Disney was political retribution, and pot legalization is a big mistake only if you ignore the value of freedom and the injustice of prohibition. These are all different stories, to be sure, and it's not exactly as if your father's GOP was super gung-ho on legal pot, but what we do see here is a growing desire, I think we see this, to use government as a tool to whack into shape any entity, including the types of private businesses that used to kind of be the bedrock of the Republican Party, at least fundraising purposes, that are deemed to be degrading to the collective well-being of society. So, Catherine, I'm appreciating every syllable of your first name today. We've had Stephanie Slade on the beat for a few years already, like from the post-fusionist look at what is happening in the right. And she writes about a lot of this stuff from a pretty pointedly critical point of view. I wanted to go in a kind of different direction today and plumb the most interesting or at least arguable parts of whatever this new conservatism thing is. So please do kick us off, if you would, on what's one societal problem that this group has been broadly correct in making their little drudge sirens about, even if their solutions to said problem are not always so great.
I'm going to give into the temptation to just go completely macro, maybe because you started us off with the macro dose. But the thing that they are right about is the fear that liberalism is a suicide pact, right? I mean, I know you wanted me to say like there's smells like pot in the streets of New York or something, but no. I think their core concern is one that has plagued anyone who pays attention to politics and who cares about American style liberalism. That is, you know, a kind of classical liberalism, not lefty liberalism. And the deal is, if you are very, very tolerant of everyone, at some point, they may not be tolerant of tolerance. And I think that is a fair fear. That is a fair critique. It is a fair concern. I think that the national conservatives and their ilk come to the wrong conclusion about what to do about that. But they're not wrong that that is always a threat.
So you're saying that liberalism is a half suicide pact? It's a potential self-harm act?
I think liberalism is at risk for self-harm is like a fair way to say it. And that it is only through vigilance about the way that policy actually gets made, through the nitty-gritty, that you can preserve this balance. And it's not like a crazy idea that we might preserve this balance. I'd say we've done a pretty good job of doing so for the past couple hundred years. But it is hard work. And what I think NatCons are saying is like, this work is too hard. And it doesn't seem like we're winning right now on some of the things we think are important. So we're going to stop doing this work. We're going to do a different project, which is just to grasp and use state power for our own ends.
So it's a needle scratch kind of thing. Like, we have to focus our attention, stop doing the usual fight, and like redirect people's attention. Peter, what say you? What is a thing that this group of people are talking about that has some validity or interest for you?
Education policy. So a huge amount of the national conservative, new right, post-Trump right, the MAGA right, whatever you want to call it, that movement or really kind of collection of movements, not all of which are totally coherent, right? It's actually hard to kind of pin all of these different groups down. A huge concern is public education and higher education. And they are at least directionally correct in a lot of cases that there are serious, deep problems with public education and with higher ed in America right now. And so I will just, I'll use one example because it's one that I'm quite familiar with. In his book, The Once and Future Worker, Orrin Cass, who is one of the sort of more technocratic types on the New Right, someone who is actually attempting to put policy specifics to some of these ideas and inclinations, writes that the current education system has basically gone all in on the college track. And so what it's college or bust, right? And as a result, it produces a lot of people who go to college and a lot of busts. And what he proposes is a public education system that is much more about student tracking and sort of and creates different options for different types of students and different potential vocations, interests, abilities, that sort of thing. Because this might not be the ideal system, right? Like this might not be exactly the sort of school choice utopia that that reason style libertarians want. But it's not a completely crazy idea. But it's also not the idea that a lot of politicians right now who are following this track themselves, right? The DeSantis types, the J.D. Vances of the world, that this is not what they're thinking about. They're not really thinking about school choice. They're not really thinking about like technocratic tweaks to, you know, exactly how we're going to track students and what sort of path we're going to put them on and allow them to have options. Instead, what they're doing is saying, well, we can't have those books in our libraries and we're going to make an issue out of it. And we're going to pass the Stop Woke Act and tell teachers to stop talking about, I don't know who they're married to or whatever. And so they've taken a very dumb, I think, and blunt culture war approach to what is a real problem, which is that American education just does badly by a lot of students.
Nick, do you have something good to say about these people or of interest from your point of view?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I think they point to, which is an empirical reality that needs to be discussed more, are declines in certain types of things like the male labor force participation rate. So if you go back to 1950, and I'm using data from the St. Louis Federal Reserve, men participated in the labor force, you know, and this is able-bodied people, 18 or 20 to 54 peak years, generally at a rate of about 87%. That's down to 68%, and it's been a long, slow, general decline. There was a rapid drop-off after the 2008 financial crisis, and then a very big drop-off after during COVID, which has come back a little bit, but it's flattened again. And I think they are their framework, you know, on everything is flatly wrong. And when it's not simply wrong kind of conceptually, they fake data. Somebody like Orrin Cass, if you look at the work of Scott Winship and others who have critiqued American Compass, they do not actually use the proper data for many of the things that they seek to measure. So they, you know, they just ignore after tax income, after tax transfers and subsidies to people and things like that. And as a result, they continue to claim that inequality is rapidly growing when it is not, that the poor, the number of people who are poor living in poverty is increasing. And that's simply not true. I mean, they're either bad or mendacious when they use facts. But this larger situation, a labor force participation rate that is substantially lower than it was in past decades and kind of continues to decline, is an empirical reality that helps to understand why people are searching for something different than the, you know, the political solutions and the political rhetoric that we've heard for years.
One way that that has translated into policy here and there in a couple of states, and it's small beer, but it's good tasting small beer, is that some Republican governors have gotten rid of degree requirements for various government related jobs, which I think is all to the good. I would throw on the pile of critiques that are been broadly true, kind of an easy one from their point of view, which is to say they've been critical of the Biden administration's approach towards COVID, particularly when it comes to things like disinformation and trying to pressure technology companies and social media companies and others to deplatform dissenting voices. It is terrible. And I think that the default setting of too much of American media is not to be upset about something that is genuinely upsetting. It would also throw in the wrinkle of like the most extreme kind of versions of national conservatisms, the Adrian Vermeules of the world, the people who are absolutely attaching themselves like barnacles to the ship of Viktor Orban in Hungary, in the first minutes of the pandemic were actually kind of more panicked about it and kind of fantasizing about what someone exercising total power for the common good would look like. And you can go back and look in like February and March of 2020. And that was where some of that thought was going at that little moment. But then I think largely that group pivoted to rightly calling out the worst of the tendencies of kind of the public health regime and et cetera.
Well, they didn't quite think in advance that when you gave the government power to shut down gatherings, that would mean shutting down churches. And this is actually, I think, like a telling tendency on their part is they were, some of them, the Vermeule types, were like, you know, sort of foaming at the mouth. Right? They were excited about the idea of using an emergency to gather a lot of power and to centralize it. And then what happened was that power was used in a way that they didn't like. And they just kind of can't seem to see that that's how it's going to work every single time.
I would also just add the, you know, it is, and Slade's work certainly does this, is to really emphasize that, they're not looking to perfect or further a liberal paradigm in which lots of different people are able to live together in relative peace and prosperity. They don't like liberalism because they don't like pluralism. They don't like tolerance. And they ultimately, their beef is against modernity. Especially if you define modernity as individuals being able to choose how they live, freely and experimentally and things like that. And they'll say that the current world order, which has, everything is run by libertarians, coming out of Switzerland or the EU, and then at the local level, it's run by progressives, you know, blue-haired women who are just forcing transgender ideology down the throat of everybody in utero.
Right, and things like that.
Yeah, no, but I mean, it is not an argument that is going to be won by appealing to the origins of the United States or to appeals to, notions of liberalism and pluralism that we hold, rightly as central to our civic kind of identity and things like that. They know what is right. They are speaking for the people, and they're going to shut down dissent. They're going to shut down economic activity they don't like. They're going to shut down all sorts of cultural activity that they find disgusting and revolting that is turning our children increasingly into, kind of asexual or even worse, multisexual, polymorphic perverts. This is the problem. And so they key into some of the sources of dissatisfaction. But without exception, their solutions are idiotic and they are antithetical, certainly to a libertarian sensibility, but it's also to a larger, broadly American live and let live, let's have different ways of living sensibility.
I think that's true even of the technocratic types like Cass. The increasing text, the foreground of his sort of his big picture argument is that the economy should be built around single male breadwinner households with a focus on factory jobs, right? And so there is an undercurrent of resentment about women entering the workforce, and that also explains the huge emphasis on industrial policy that Cass and the other sort of MAGA Trump types really place on economic policy.
Catherine, you're a woman and you're sitting right there. No, a lot of the attacks on libertarianism that Nick is referring to, they occasionally will stray some fire and bullets in our direction, particularly at Slade, because she keeps kicking this hornet's nest. What are some of the interesting, maybe even plausible critiques of libertarianism that we've seen there? Or is it all as silly as attacks on libertarianism usually tend to be?
Yeah, I definitely consider a part of my job to be just like providing like Hornet protective gear for Slade. Like, just like go in there and kick it again, girl. But yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, Nick was joking earlier about how part of this critique is like the libertarians have been in charge for too long. And that kind of stance or that line has made me rethink, you know, the kind of scale at which I should think about libertarian successes and libertarian influence on the culture. And I think previously mentally, I had put libertarianism in a kind of different category from what you might describe as neoliberalism, which I would say is, in fact, what has been in charge for this time, right, globally. Jesse Walker wrote a really, really excellent feature a while back, basically pointing out that no one has any idea what that word means. And so I am kind of happy to say, well, at least something, one part of what it means is a lot of the stuff, a lot of the DNA that they share with people who would call themselves libertarians. And so, you know, I think this insight that there really has been an ascendancy of many libertarian or libertarian adjacent values. And also in that time, some things have not gone perfectly, right? Like, that's a fair point. Like, there are trade-offs for individuals, for societies. I think that there's sort of an overwhelmingly powerful case for the net good that changes, like, more open trade and free movement of people and, you know, more robust media and speech rights all around the world. But they are right that there have been losers. And so this sort of ties into what Suderman said as well. One thing that I think is interesting is that we have within libertarianism a lot of people who have seen these same problems and doubled down on liberalism and pluralism, which I think is the right approach. So, like, many of our younger staffers, they tend to be more religious, more personally conservative. That's true of the whole generation, but it's true even within the libertarian movement. And I think that one reaction to seeing that your culture, which used to be dominant, is no longer dominant, is to say, we have to do whatever it takes to become dominant again. And another reaction is to say, hey, let's make space for non-dominant cultures. Let's make more space for minorities. Me, now a, you know, very observant Christian, I'm more of a minority than I used to be. Let's reconsider how to make space for my life. I think that's the right reaction, but I see the temptation that the NatCons face. The Theocons, let's say. That's more of a Theocon issue than a NatCon issue.
There's definitely overlap. And all of these, you know, by necessity, all these categories are kind of fluid and not rigid. And
non-binary.
They kind of, thank you, Nick, for recognizing my pain. Peter, speaking of pain, what are there any of these critiques of libertarianism in here that resonate or that libertarians should learn from?
Are there any critiques of libertarianism are true?
Among these populist conservatives who are frequently sharpening their arrows and pointing them in the direction of libertarians, are any of those sharpened arrows true?
That metaphor made it worse, not better. I just want to say.
I'm just reiterating the question that was part of the preparation for this episode in the Slack channel on Friday so that Peter remembered it. Go on.
Yeah. So I suppose I would say that I think most of their critiques of libertarianism are misguided and tend to misunderstand libertarianism. At the same time, they sometimes end up inadvertently revealing weaknesses in the way that libertarians communicate. And so just a huge amount of the complaints about libertarians assume that we control like all policy, which is wrong. Also that we don't really care about a lot of types of people or family arrangements or just like they assume a kind of heartlessness on the part of libertarians that I think is really, really misunderstands the project and why people are motivated by libertarianism. At the same time, I do think that they, at their best or at their most potent anyway, force libertarians, or at least force the smart libertarians, to address things that they might not otherwise have addressed or have addressed quite as forcefully. I think family formation is a big issue that libertarians kind of don't talk about and don't have a great language for talking about. And the emphasis on family formation. It's not that no one knows how to say any words about that, right? Like Nick's gonna I can see his face on his camera here, right? Like it's not that no one has ever talked about that who identifies as a libertarian, who is like a spokesman for libertarian ideas, but it's something that libertarians have talked about less and is just a hugely important issue to a lot of people out there right now. And so getting us to talk more about that sort of thing. Similarly, stuff like deaths from fentanyl, right? And sort of the stuff even just sort of related to what Nick was talking about earlier, sort of the quasi sense of despair that seems to be lurking at the heart of a lot of the critiques of libertarianism, also like in our politics, and maybe I'm not sure. It's actually hard to say whether this is like a real thing out in the populace or not, but it's certainly there in the intellectual discourse layer of American society right now. I don't think that most of the critiques of libertarianism coming from the NatCons really get who we are and what we do and what we're about. I don't think that they are really deeply right. I do think they press us to talk about things that we might not otherwise talk about and reveal concerns that libertarians aren't as naturally focused on talking about directly.
Nick, can you translate your facial expression into words when it comes to, yeah?
I don't think so. That's why their expressions, Matt. I choose a different platform for different feelings or inchoate
Nick's
thoughts.
Face is worth 1,000
yeah.
words at least.
Yeah, it's
a
art,
social
right?
media.
Like if an artist has to explain
platform.
His painting or his movie.
You know, what I'll tell a very brief story. I went to the Calvin Coolidge presidential, you know, flim-flammery institutions dinner a while ago, and I ran into a guy who's in his mid-30s who used to be a Reason-style libertarian, and he caught up with me and he was like, hey, I am now like a Flight 93 Claremont conservative. Like, I am a NatCon, I am a Trump-tard. I believe, you know, the plane is going down, but instead of hitting, you know, the World Trade Center, it's literally saying he believes that the the goal of the cathedral or of the progressive blob is to mandate drag time story hour, you know, 6 hours a day in government schools. And, you know, I found that interesting. And I said, you know, what happened? He also is from a refugee family. So he's he's an ethnic minority and was a religious minority who has now embraced, quite frankly, I think the dumbest form of American identity in the 21st century, which is that we need to go back to this fake imagined moment in the 50s where men were men, women were women, everybody had 3.2 kids, a couple of, you know, a dog, and you lived in Levittown or something like that. I don't mean to disparage that in the sense he fully believes it, and he's been whatever that is, red-pilled? I don't know. It's like Trump-pilled or something. But I asked, like, what happened? Like, why aren't you a Reason-style libertarian? And he said that you don't offer a positive vision of the world.
sorry.
No, but that was it. You know, and that, I don't think it's an accurate read, but it points to what the people who tend to be national conservatives or trads are looking for is a kind of more fully articulated reality, which might not scratch every itch that they have, but it's out there. You can walk through that world. You can read it like a catalog, like a Sears wish book, the Christmas catalog or something. Everything is covered. Everything is in there. And I think libertarianism hasn't done that, and we haven't been doing that particularly well since the ascent of Trump. We're not going to be able to, because all we can do is kind of show different possibilities. But not emphasizing the positive outcomes of the things that we believe in, many of which have been achieved and attained. Last week on a live stream that I did with Liz Nolan Brown and Scott Winship of AEI, where we were talking about natalism that based on Liz's cover story, which is great and should be read. You know, one of the things that fell out of the conversation over the past couple of years of declines in birth rates is like people on the left and the right were just like, this is a disaster. This is a civilizational apocalypse. And it's like, no, actually, that's the wrong frame to look at it. It reflects the fact that more people have more autonomy over their lives and they are choosing different things. And our job is to understand what is the benefit of that. What is the utopian, you know, energy of that? It's not worse that, you know, three of us on this call are parents and we have two kids rather than four kids or even three kids. That's not in any way a tragedy. It's a success story for living in a world where we have more control over how many fucking kids we have. And we need to talk more, I think, not aggressively, but more positively about the things that have changed in life that make life better for the people who are making the choices that result in a world that NatCons are kind of pissed about because it's lippy, you know, lippy women, you know, the what
again,
you
know, that's I'm right a, no, here.
Yeah, no, but I mean, that is the big problem, right? That women aren't wifely and submissive enough, that, you know, that men, particularly white men who were employed at, you know, 87% in 1950 are now at 68%. Part of it is like, you know, they need to man up. I mean, like they need to work more, or maybe it's that we don't need as many people working and we're still really wealthy. But I think the thing that they key into is that libertarians often spend a lot of time just critiquing everything that comes down the pike rather than saying, you know what, it's kind of fucking great when you look at the music scene, when you look at the literature scene, when you look at you know, movies and TVs and forms of creative expression. And it's not, oh, we have too many things to choose from. It's confusing. Please help me by reducing the amount of material that's available to me. It's like we need to be reveling in this. This is we're living in a like a fantastic world. And yet we often engage in the apocalyptic rhetoric of critics, particularly of libertarianism, who say, you know, Tucker Carlson, we have so much stuff, but it's all plastic junk from China. Bernie Sanders, we have 23 flavors of sneakers and deodorant, and that's too much. You don't, all you need is Old Spice and Lady Old Spice. You know, it's like, no, that's wrong. We're living in a better world, and we should do a better job of explaining what's great about it, and then what are the obstacles to making it even better, which would result in a world that the NatCons would hate even more. But that's their problem, because they are literally and figuratively, or they're figuratively living in the past.
I'm still holding out for Secret for Men.
Yeah.
But that's
we've all
that's
used it in a pinch, Matt.
You know, as long as it comes in a gray container.
Yeah. And it's you can rename the scent something manly. Has to be right. Like
those are
power tools. Secret.
Speaking of bulldozing through this segment, speaking of the Republican Party and its adaptations in the time owed Trump, last week and this week, it is becoming increasingly clear that the anti-Trump or not quite Trump element of the GOP is following up its strategic folly of throwing a crowded field of competitors at the presidential frontrunner in 2015 and 2016 by throwing a crowded field of competitors at the presidential frontrunner in 2023. Today, I think we'll see the official announcement of South Carolina Senator Tim Scott. Last week featured a lot of trial ballooning from former New Jersey governor and 2016 presidential splat on the windshield, Chris Christie. Plus, we saw some Reagan-esque noises from Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin for some reason. We had some fun at our live show, and thank you again for going to it and watching it afterwards. We did a little segment called Why This President Would Be Terrible, I think it was called. It was a bit tongue-in-cheek or over the top, but it also kind of reflected our instinctive sentiment that presidents are quite frequently terrible. So we're going to do a similar exercise this week since we got some new fresh meat on the table. So let's start with Suderman. Why would Glenn Youngkin be terrible as a president.
So as you mentioned, Youngkin recently released a 1-minute ad comparing himself to Ronald Reagan. And I think that's my answer, actually. I think that's, I'm just going to end there.
No, so how many slow motion flags were in that thing? Just like the strings.
It's worth watching that ad, because what that ad was a distilled, set to music and imagery version of the speech that he gave at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library recently, as part of the Time for Choosing series, which is just great. And it's worth watching that ad because it's so incredibly generic. It's not even awful enough to be cringe. It's just like, this has been going on for a full 34 seconds and there's 26 seconds more. I'm not sure I can make it through. Right. But it just covers all the stuff that Republicans used to talk about. The speech and the ad right there. It's taxes. It's regulation. It's education. It's public safety. It's jobs and the economy. And the speech was in a lot of ways pretty inoffensive. And a reminder of what Republicans used to be like, which is not so great, but not so terrible either, at least on some economic issues. Kind of boring, kind of generic. And Youngkin's point with this ad was, well, Reagan did that stuff. I am like Reagan. And then his spokespeople are like, oh, he's just focused on Virginia right now. But, you know, he's like Reagan. Wink, wink. And it's a reminder of like what Republicans used to be like. But even as a generic Republican, you also get stuff that is a reminder that Youngkin is going to be kind of bad in the ways that generic Republicans have just become bad now. So there is a line in that speech that he gave. This is not from the ad, but it's in the speech the ad is based on. We need an American revolution. In order to no longer depend on Chinese manufacturing, we need to bring semiconductors, pharmaceuticals, automotive supply chains here to the United States. And then he goes on and rants about TikTok and China and the threat that China poses to the American economy and American dominance in the world. And okay, sure, like there is a little bit of Reagan-esque kind of like America is the best and we must crush our foreign adversaries in that. But also it's like that's where Glenn Youngkin is at, and that's what we would get from him as president, but it doesn't matter because he is not going to be president, and that's maybe the number one reason why he would be a bad president, is there's absolutely no way that he is going to win a presidential election in 2024.
Nick, speaking of people who are not going to win a presidential election in 2024, what, if anything, would make Chris Christie a not ideal president of these United States?
Yeah. Christie, who was a 2-term governor of my home state of New Jersey, became famous. And it's hard to remember this because it's in political years. It's, you know, 1,000 Nancy Pelosi's ago. And also at least one gastric bypass surgery for Governor Christie ago. But he got famous for yelling at teachers. At a campaign event or something, where he told teachers to kind of shut up because they were getting paid a lot and they were doing a bad job. And that briefly captured a kind of moment in, you know, kind of the most New Jersey terms possible. He was going to be a kind of, you know, and this is going back to the late aughts, early teens, he was going to be a guy who told it like it was. And he said, you know, rightly, that New Jersey is always in the top 4 or 5 states, typically in the top 3 for combined state and local taxes. It is highly regulated. It used to be a tax haven from New York, Connecticut, which is one of the other highest states. They grew their economies, particularly of wealthy, productive people, by charging less tax than New York. That is all gone now. He was going to tackle taxes. He was going to break the teachers' union so that they taught rather than complained all the time and things like that. And he did not really deliver on any of that. He kept taxes down at various points. He cut certain taxes. He reduced spending. The Cato Institute gave him a grade in their 2014 governor's report of B. But he was not a transformative figure. And as a result, you look at him, he got mired in Bridgegate, which I don't know if people remember that, but he had an aide who, as a payback against a local politician, slowed down traffic coming into New Jersey across the George Washington Bridge, which Christie kind of skated from that, but it was like, why would you hire people who would do that? I mean, it's just insane. Then the real problem with Chris Christie is he sucked up to Donald Trump in all sorts of ways and then kind of got backhanded. The function of Chris Christie in this election cycle, and it may be an important one, is that he is going to be an attack dog from inside the House of Trump. But he's an uninspiring and uninspired leader who, had he done half or even a third of what he said he was going to do, he might be the type of governor who could go into Washington and actually affect change, but not.
Catherine, one character that some Beltway cosmetarians have always said nice things about is New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu. I don't know how many N's are in his name, but there's at least two and maybe seven. you've had at least an hour to think about this question. So why would Chris Sununu not be the president of Beltway cosmetarians' dreams?
Yeah, I'm going to give some substance in a minute. But first, I do want to say, I got to work this morning and I was like, hey, everybody, what do we know about John Sununu?
Yeah.
So that, right there.
John.
Yeah. Yep. Right there. That tells you kind of where we're at. I think not just me, but also as a country with respect to Chris Sununu, which is to say, we are dimly aware that there may or may not be a politician with the name Sununu just out there doing stuff. I looked in the box labeled Sununu in my head, Chris Sununu, I guess, and it just had in it like two spiders and some sawdust. And so I was like, okay, let me figure out what I know about this guy. And, you know, he's beloved of Beltway cosmotarians for a reason. Rolling Stone called him a hardcore libertarian, which strikes me as something of an overstatement. But, you know, he did some licensing reform. He's like a melting, his family's like a melting pot situation, which is nice. His stance on abortion seems really moderate. He's a guy who's like a Republican. He seems fine. But it doesn't matter because he's not going to be president. He is polling at 17% in the New Hampshire primary, where he, you may or may not know, is governor. But no one knows that. Maybe not even the people in New Hampshire, is one thing that I'm concluding. He has said that there's a 61% chance that he will run, which, again, as a Beltway cosmetarian, I'm charmed by the weird specificity of that percentage. But it would...
Did he do a regression?
Probably.
To get that number?
P-hacked that number? I don't know. But he's not going to be a good president because he's not going to be president. That's simply not a thing that's going to occur. And unfortunately, it's not going to occur in part because of the things that he said, which sound okay to me. Like, he really seems to be choosing largely to eschew the culture war politics that are pretty clearly the rainbow highway to the GOP nomination at this point. And it's hard for me to imagine him getting there.
Well, that would be good, though, if he and a couple of the other Republicans in the primary system really start articulating an anti-culture war perspective. It might not work this time around, particularly with Trump and DeSantis in the, you know, number one and number two slots going in. But that's good, right?
Well,
I mean, to see a Republican Party get away from that.
Yeah, it just gets us into the kind of electoral math. And this is like the least novel point one can make on a political podcast in 2023. But like, if there's a whole bunch of guys in the Republican field and Trump is also running, we know how that goes. And so I struggle to say, well, it's good if they get the message out there and lose this time. But maybe in the long run, if they lose this time, looks like another Trump presidency.
I'm all for the anti-culture war argument, but we see how that worked out so well for Mitch Daniels. Like, it did great things for the tuition at Purdue.
Don't hurt my heart.
I just like Chris Sununu's quote from last month when he was doing the TV circuit on how he might or might not run. And he said, "I think I could do the job."
You know what, just, though? God bless.
Yes, I know. See, Beltway cosmetarian. I wasn't wrong, yeah, Catherine.
I know. Of course you're not wrong. He did do one little bit of culture war. which is that they banned Russian vodka from the state liquor stores in New Hampshire when
Live
Putin
free or die
Ukraine. But that, you know, the problem there is more like
the
why
problem is
in
vodka.
God's name? Well, two problems. One, vodka. Two, why is the governor choosing what vodka is stocked in the state, which we've covered elsewhere extensively.
All right. My entry in this category is Tim Scott, who announces today, the senator from South Carolina, arguments against he doesn't drink. He's a former insurance salesman. Nick, he's a Cowboys fan and especially a Tony Dorsett fan. I mean, come on. Worked for Strom Thurmond. Never been married and has no kids, although there's anything wrong with that. He really likes Cameo's Word Up. He talks unironically about opportunity zones. It's a zombie Jack Kemp thing. He's a immigration and abortion restrictionist, although he's sort of fuzzy on the abortion stuff. Won't tell you how many weeks is his Maginot line on immigration. He introduced a Stop Dangerous Sanctuary Cities Act last month. And he's tweeted out such things as soon as he took office, President Biden stopped enforcing America's immigration laws, rolled back effective border policies, and offered the world a clear incentive to illegally enter the U.S. I think that's a little bit overstated. Having said all that, I like Tim Scott. I like him. I wish him well. If of all the people who are polling above 1%, which isn't a lot of people, I probably like him the best, just like as a likable thing. He's all about like personal story, single mom household. He's really unironic. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Most people hate that. I still like it. American dream. He's genuinely, and this is actually part of the thing that I like about the aspirations, at least, of the National Cons. Is that there's the sense of the culture of the median GOP voter and the Democratic voter are changing. The Democratic Party is becoming a party of kind of managerial elites. Republican Party is more working class. Tim Scott is actually more authentically from what one might call working class than almost anybody who's otherwise out there selling that bit of snake oil. And I genuinely appreciate that. Like pro wrestling fan. He was a part of the Tea Party cycle in 2010, which people don't really remember, but he's been good on police reform, criminal justice reform, co-sponsored the First Step Act, sponsored bills to go after qualified immunity. Billy Binion has written several times nice things about Tim Scott. And he's also very unabashedly pro-school choice, introduced the Choice Act now, which would basically make all COVID education spending pure like backpack funding situations. When he came to Congress, he was lambasting the pork in the military budget. And so there's some good things to say about Tim Scott. I agree that it's hard for anyone to run for president. But I think he's going to at least register a pulse, unlike many of the other candidates that we talked about even so far in this podcast. There's arguments against him, but I kind of like him. All right. Okay. We're going to get to our listener question of the week here in a moment. But first, a reminder that this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Friends, are we all out there having enough me time? Is your life, work, family, relationship balance all about everybody else's needs without checking in on the driver? It's easy to get so caught up in the day-to-day that you forget to focus on presenting your best and most internally aligned self to the world that you otherwise give so much attention to. That's where BetterHelp Online Therapy comes in. BetterHelp is an easy-to-use, super flexible, entirely online therapy service that has helped many, many listeners of this very podcast. All you have to do is fill out a quick questionnaire, get matched with a therapist, then start working on your own damned self for a change. Stop feeling stretched and thin, like butter over too much bread. Just visit BetterHelp.com/roundtable today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay. Reminder, send your email queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Brian LaRocca, who writes, I lean open borders, but the roundtable strawmans the other side's concerns. George Borjas's work at Harvard details how most low-skilled immigration is a drag on growth and adversely affects the wages of natives. Garrett Jones's recent book shows how cultural differences persist and can change how innovative a society is. The current debacle at the border has led cities' finances to go into the red as a quasi-open borders policy is met with government largesse and welfare. And these are just the asylum seekers. Many known getaways, who presumably are pretty iffy if they won't seek the free entry of asylum, are meandering around the country unvetted. Will the roundtable ever give credence to these debatable points, Catherine?
Yeah, I mean, we have, I guess, is my main answer. And not on the roundtable specifically, maybe, although I think we have alluded to both Garrett Jones and Borjas over the years. But I urge the letter writer to check out a really good 2016 debate that we published where Borjas was a participant. So, you know, we gave him not only, you know, an airing, but in fact, thousands of words to make his case in our pages. We reviewed the Garrett Jones book in a couple issues ago. Also, I think gave it a serious consideration. Of course, there is immigration dysfunction. Of course, there are bad things about immigration. I think that fans of open borders are making not the case that more immigration is always good and perfect and has no problems, but instead that many of the things that folks who are worried about open borders, the things that they're worried about, some of them can be, in fact, solved with open borders or at least mitigated by more legal entry. And to me, that is taking those concerns seriously. It's just disagreeing about what to do after that.
Nick, will your roundtable ever give credence to these debatable points?
You know what? I think there's a lot of analysis on all of this. And even people like George Borjas agree that immigration on balance is a good thing. One of the things that I think libertarians can spend a little bit more time talking about is the broader picture of how do you create what Arthur Diamond Jr. in a 2019 book that's very much worth reading from Oxford University Press, create what's called openness to creative destruction. The way economies flourish is not by locking down at a particular moment when things seem to be going well. It's by constantly changing and morphing and restructuring themselves in the name of what Schumpeter, the originator of the phrase creative destruction, called the endless mutations that happen in a society, not just in the economic sphere, but in the cultural sphere, in response to people's changing demands. And one of the things, it is true that there are small subsectors of the American workforce that might momentarily get displaced by unskilled immigration, like low-skilled immigration. That's not always the case. And actually, even people like Borjas has shown where oftentimes those workers end up, the native workers end up doing better. But we need to create an appreciation for how the economy changes and functions and grows to increase the general, you know, level of wealth and opportunity in America. And one of the ways that we do that is by helping people who struggle because they get displaced. And we should be talking more about that in the context of immigration. Because the way it is now, it's always the argument gets posed is that we would be in a great shape if we could just really close the borders, or maybe only admit elite workers who don't threaten me directly. That isn't how the country works. It's not how the economy works. But we need to be helping everybody understand that, you know, an economy is like a body aging in time. You got to change your routine. You got to change your diet. You got to step up on certain things, give up other things. And how do you adjust that? That's the real question.
Peter, do you have words to address this question?
Immigration is a net good for the economy, and there's very little dispute about that. The dispute then ends up being about some of the sort of potential smaller harms. And I guess I would say that I disagree to some extent with the way that the listener has characterized what's happening at the border. The writer calls it a quasi-open borders policy. And I don't think that's the right way to understand what's happening at the border right now. What we have is a quasi-locked down border policy. That's what's on the books. And then it's being enforced and run and managed quite badly. And a policy that that opens up the border much more than we have right now would allow authorities to focus more on vetting potential problem cases while just letting a lot of other people in. And that would, again, be good for the economy and good overall. It would reduce a bunch of the chaos. The letter writer also notes that there are cost issues in terms of dealing with immigrants in terms of welfare policy. But that sounds to me more like a welfare policy problem than an immigration problem. And in addition, I would just sort of say that these are issues that we have debated not only in our pages, but sort of in the libertarian world quite extensively. So Catherine mentioned a bunch of our coverage already, but I would also just encourage this person to read basically everything written by Alex Nowresta of the Cato Institute over the past decade or so. He has engaged in a deep back and forth with immigration critics and has made, I think, a very persuasive case that to the extent there is anything that we might think of as a harm, say displacement of some workers, it's really quite minimal, and that most of the research purporting to show significant harms and displacement of low-skilled workers is actually based on shoddy science and shoddy data or just misunderstanding of how to use that data. And he's also then made a case that more immigration, low-skilled and high-skilled, basically as much as you can manage while also sorting out some people who may have highly problematic criminal backgrounds or communicable diseases. That's the two categories of people I do think we clearly want to keep out. Focusing on that while then just letting other people who want to come here and work, let them come here and work. It will be better for them. It will be better for us. It will also reduce the chaos at the border, and we will end up with a better, freer, richer, more prosperous society.
Yeah, and if I may, just real quickly to build on what Peter's saying, and I know I fall into this problem too, it's wrong to focus on economics all of the time. It's a big part of it. It is one of the ways that our economy gets restructured and changed and revitalized, but also, you know, we need to be making the case, and I think we do at Reason, that immigrants are also good for the culture. They enrich and enliven everything that we do, not simply by starting companies at higher than native-born rates, which they do. But when you think about the experiences that you have, the food that you eat, the kind of culture that you consume, immigrants are good. And I've lived, I think alone among the people on this podcast, I lived in the interior, you know, in District 8 or wherever Katniss Everdeen was from for the better part of 20 years. And it was a place with relatively few immigrants. And it's a place that is economically and culturally not doing as well as the places where immigrants tend to be. It's not, you know, they partly go to places where there's economic and cultural opportunity and things like that. But there is a very, very strong case for allowing more legal immigrants to come here, not just to work, but to live, because they make us a better country. They make us a richer, more interesting, more innovative, and more resilient country.
I'm married to an immigrant, a naturalized citizen now, and so that doesn't necessarily make me more pro-immigration. It actually sensitizes me to the concept of fairness that a lot of recent immigrants have. You know, it's the kind of get in line. I did it my way. Why are you jumping the line type of thing? And I hope that I've been trying to, in my writing and talking about immigration for a quarter century, have been trying to address those senses, particularly fairness. I think it's one of the biggest things that people feel is out of whack, and it sort of offends their being, the sense of unfairness when people come here in violation of existing law. I would point out to Catherine's pointing, and basically everybody's, go to the August 2006 special issue we did on immigration. We did another one in October 2008. The recent debate issue in May of 2023 had a debate about open borders. We have engaged in these issues over and over again over the years and have taken them seriously, I think. But go and read it and judge for yourself and get back to us. Let us know how we did. All right. Let's go to our end of podcast, what we have all been consuming in the cultural arena. Catherine, do you want to lead us off?
Yeah. I read a new collection of short stories from Sarah Pinsker. We have recommended her books on this podcast before. And this collection came out earlier this month. It's really good. It's called Lost Places. And it's a little bit eerier, I would say, than some of her past work. It's got a little more Twilight Zone energy, a little more Mandela effect channeling. You know, can't trust your own memories, can't trust your own perceptions, that kind of thing. And I really liked it. Always, when I read short stories, especially of the world-building, science fiction-y type, I remember that much like all argumentative nonfiction books should be magazine articles, there's an awful lot of novels out there that should be short stories. And I think Sarah Pinsker is good at knowing which are which.
Nick, what did you consume?
I read Excellent Advice for Living, Wisdom I Wish I'd Known Earlier by Kevin Kelly. Kevin Kelly was one of the early editors at Wired magazine. Before that, he worked with people like Stuart Brand at Coevolution Quarterly. In the 90s in particular, he wrote some of the most kind of visionary books about the coming digital culture world and whatnot, and he's proceeded apace with that. He runs a website called Cool Things, which is kind of an online version of the Whole Earth catalog. What is great about this book, he is now 70 or in his early 70s, and it's a series of aphorisms about stuff he wish he had known earlier. And they include, I'll just read a couple quick ones. You can't reason someone out of a notion that they didn't reason themselves into. Gratitude will unlock all other virtues and is something you can get better at. Pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. There's a lot of these, and they have a very interesting kind of effect. What I like about Kevin Kelly is that he is acting in a way as a kind of village elder. He is literally a graybeard. He is not a weird kind of dunk on the young people or rhapsodize about the past. He's constantly been either building or reporting on people who have been building new worlds or new experiments with the freedom that both technology and politics and commerce have given us over the past, 50 or 60 or 70 years. So it's great, and it's a kind of transgenerational sharing of wisdom and of insight and of kind of openness to change and to learning. So Kevin Kelly, Excellent Advice for Living, Wisdom I Wish I'd Known Earlier.
Peter, what did you consume?
I watched Fast X, the latest installment in the Fast and Furious franchise. And I have to say, it kind of left me furious. No, my reaction sadly wasn't even that strong. But this movie is a multi-car pileup of just like obnoxious franchise film crap. It's just muddled, incoherent, and not very fun, which is a real problem because the Fast and the Furious franchise at its best, and I often have liked these movies, but when they work, they're sort of cheesy, macho telenovelas that take place in a world where street racing hot rods have superpowers, right? This is not quite superhero movies, but the cars can fly and disobey the laws of physics in ways that are fun and clever. And this movie has a bunch of cars kind of doing stuff that cars can't really do, and it's not fun, and it's not clever. And the only thing that is sometimes fun in it is that Jason Momoa plays the new villain with a kind of just crazed scene-chewing glee that is a little bit unusual for the franchise, but also just... kind of undermines the joy of it, because the joy of this series is that as goofy as it gets, it always takes itself seriously. It doesn't seem to be truly in on the joke, right? On the one hand, it's giving you the most ridiculous stuff you've ever seen on screen. And on the other hand, it's saying, yeah, of course these guys feel that way. They have a lot of feelings that they solve by jumping their cars over things.
The other car guys are their family, right?
Right, because it's all about family. And this movie is not all about family, and it's not all about fun, and it's just noisy and obnoxious, and I can't recommend it.
Sometimes well, then.
Something that's all about family is noisy and obnoxious. Have you thought about that, Suderman?
Oedipus Rex is all about family. Would you recommend that?
Not yet. I'm still waiting on that. I have to digest it. I watched for the, I think the first time since it came out. It's hard to say because memory. The Two Towers. Watched that yesterday with my 8-year old. It's actually a pretty, and I wouldn't have mentioned this otherwise, but for anyone else who has been in that position, they watched it when it came out, loved it, hated it, whatever, but particularly if they liked it, it's pretty trippy to watch it again because those movies came out very much in just the fog of 9/11 and the Iraq War, just in the buildup to the war and whatever. It was read culturally through those lens, like we must do something to confront the evil power. And it's liberating to watch it again 20 years later, and you don't really actually have any of those notes in it. It was just read into it. I presumed actually that would have more of it. I think maybe the Fellowship of the Ring did have more kind of a wink in those directions, but the Two Towers didn't. So you get to watch it again as much more of a World War II fable as it is. It's beginning of the war, basically, in the movie. And I know that Tolkien discouraged people to see all of the many obvious similarities to World War II, but that's dumb and you shouldn't read it that way. And I had forgotten by just the sort of depiction of the horrors of the war, of the of villages being burned and people dying and just the misery of refugee populations and whatnot. It was more like showing the stark realities of war than I remember it. I remembered it being more gung-ho. The Ents still suck, and they look even worse than ever. Chop. Yes, the Ents.
You're anti-Ent?
I love Ents as a concept. Come on. Burahum or whatever. But like the CGI of the Ents is what I mean. They suck. They're good people. They feel a little bit slow. But anyways, it's worth checking out. Two Towers. All right. That's all of the Gillespie chuckling we have time for, although I think we might have a little bit of time at the end of this program, which we're at now, see, recursive loops and all that, to talk about what's coming up next in terms of events in the great city of New York. Nick Gillespie, what's happening?
On Monday, June 5th, we're going to do a live taping of the Reason Interview podcast that we call the Reason Speakeasy in Midtown at the Blue Building on 46th Street, one of the greatest venues ever in New York. It's a wonderful gem hidden inside a totally kind of bland block of Midtown Manhattan, down from where Paul Castellano was shot, exiting Spark Steakhouse. The guest is Kat Timpf. The Fox News regular who's on Gutfeld all the time and has a great new best-selling book called You Can't Joke About That. So we're going to talk about comedy as a healing mechanism in contemporary society. But it's June 5th with Kat Timpf. Go to reason.com events to get tickets and more information.
And go to reason.com/podcasts for all of our podcast goodness. And reason.com/donate in case you want to give us money so that we do more content that you like. Okay, we'll see next year, week, all those times. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.